Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. On the show today, we're going for a nose around some other people's pads. Don't worry, not going for a rummage in their underwear drawer. We're looking specifically at art galleries in homes. All around the world, art lives in houses, from stately homes with impeccable art collections to small studios of young artists at the end of their garden that are opened up to the public. Today, we'll be wandering from Cambridge to Cape Town and Victoria to Vienna to explore some galleries set in cosy locations and see how many of these spaces offer a lesson in curation. That is all coming up on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. When we think about 20th century modern art, we tend to picture a Miro painting against a plain white museum wall, or a Barbara Hepworth sculpture sat on a plinth inside a glass case. But late visionary art collector and Tate curator Jim Eade set out to show that art can be appreciated in a domestic context too. After renovating and linking together three derelict cottages in Cambridge, he filled his new home with hand-picked pieces of modern art. Known as Kettle's Yard, he opened his home to the public in the afternoons for all to enjoy his art. From the black Brancusi head perched on his living room's grand piano to a Henry Moore piece sat atop a wooden chest of drawers, there's a certain intimacy about appreciating art in the home. His last wish, that a gallery be added to the house where exhibitions change periodically. Daphne Karnazes visited Kettle's Yard to meet the director, Andrew Nairn.
When I say I'm the director of Kettle's Yard to people who know us, and they are thinking particularly of the house with the collection, they say, how incredibly lucky you are, it's my favourite place in the world. And they say that because, unlike other house museums, or indeed any other museum, there's something very unique and special about Kettle's Yard. There are no labels, you can sit down pretty much anywhere, and there's this extraordinary arrangement created by Jim Eade of mixing up remarkable art from the 20th century with found objects, whether they're pebbles or shells or bits of burnt wood. And so he asks radical questions around value and around creativity. So some of the objects in Kettle's Yard are worth a great deal of money in financial terms, and others are worth nothing. And you can do it today. You can make that visual arrangement. And so it's been extremely inspirational to all kinds of people thinking about their own homes and their houses, because Jim Eade was passionate about the idea of art and life coming together, and the idea that you should experience great art in a sort of domestic environment, in a house, in a home, and you should feel that by sitting down and relaxing.
But actually, his collection was so big that it perhaps didn't all fit in the house, so was that part of the reason that the galleries were built? And tell me about the new extension and what people who haven't been here for the past few years will see different.
So in 1970, three very small little galleries for temporary changing exhibitions were built, and over the next 20, 30 years, those galleries were extended. But really, they were not in a good shape in the last sort of 5 or 10 years. So we've rebuilt those galleries, completely remodeled them, and at the same time, we've built what we call the education wing, which is a wonderful series of rooms, three very expansive rooms, where all kinds of education and research can happen for all ages. Why does that matter? Because the Kettle's Yard house is in a sense about, education sounds too harsh, it's about a kind of learning, it's a kind of experience, but there's so much to talk about and discuss, and so many possibilities for people to make art, that we wanted to have the rooms alongside the house and collection where that could be possible.
Tell me about the collaboration with Jamie Fober, the architect behind the extension, and how did you decide to use him?
I didn't choose Jamie Fober. My predecessor, Michael Harrison, did, but I was very pleased to inherit Jamie Fober as the architect. He is a brilliant, extraordinary architect based in the UK, based in London, and he's very sensitive to the history of Kettle's Yard. The extension that we're standing in now in 1970 was designed by Leslie Martin, who was also responsible for leading on the Royal Festival Hall in the 1950s, a remarkable modernist architect. And Jamie, in his extension, the two galleries, the education wing, is very much responding to Leslie Martin and to the history of the site, and very sensitively thinking about light and space. We're trying to still give a sort of sense of the domestic, of the home, throughout the whole project and in the materials that we've used. We want people to feel comfortable when they come to Kettle's Yard. We do want them to be challenged as well. And it's important to say that the art that Jim Eade collected, the art that Jim Eade was given by artists, is in many ways radical. It is not all quiet and contemplative, although that might be the overall experience of the house. It's radical, extraordinary, experimental art. And that's what we want to show in our exhibition spaces as well.
What will be the opening exhibition when it opens in February?
We decided to open with a big, ambitious group show called Actions, The Image of the World Can Be Different. And the second part, The Image of the World Can Be Different, is a quotation from someone called Noam Garbo, a remarkable artist originally born in Russia, but then traveled to different parts of the world. And it's about the idea that the visual arts give us alternative images about how we might act in the world, how we might see the world, how we might perceive the world. And so it's 38 artists. Some of them are historic, some of them are contemporary. Cornelia Parker, Edmund Duval, Oscar Murillo. I could go through the list. We're really thrilled that some of really the best artists in the United Kingdom and from around the world are either lending us work or making new work for this exhibition. And it isn't just in the galleries. It's in the lift. It's in the church next door. It's on T-shirts. And every artist in the show is making art with very real purpose. That's why it's called Actions. It's about going back to the idea that making art at its best is making a change in the world, is making us see something differently.
Could you show me some of your... I know it's a difficult question, but some of your favourite artworks here.
We're looking at Henry Gaudia Breschke's Bird Swallowing Fish, which is made to look like a bronze, but in fact is made of plaster. And this is by the extraordinary French artist who came to London in 1911, very little money, and then was tragically to die in the First World War, aged only 23 in 1915. And Jim Eade, when he was working at the Tate, discovered that all of the work left behind by Gaudia Breschke after he was killed in the First World War was available, and he ended up buying it all, hundreds of sculptures, thousands of drawings. And in a sense, Kettle's Yard, dotted around Kettle's Yard, are many works by Gaudia Breschke. This particular one is still shocking. It appears to show a bird of some description swallowing a fish, but the minute you look at it, you realise that the fish in the bird's mouth is like a bomb. And this is seen, it was made in 1914, it's seen as prefiguring or imagining the war that was about to come. It's like a mechanized version of nature. It's like nature's been perverted. But actually, it remains a shocking sculpture. Here we are, more than 100 years later, and this is still an unresolved sculpture. So what makes it modern is that you don't know whether the bird is going to swallow the fish or whether the bird is going to choke. Exactly. You don't know what's going to happen. It's intention. So it was described when it was shown at the Tate Gallery as part of the Vorticism exhibition, which was this avant-garde art movement before the First World War that Gaudia Breschke was part of. It was described as a Vorticist masterpiece.
And Jim Eade has placed it on a tree trunk.
He's placed it on a huge tree trunk, which I think, if my memory is right, he brought over. It was very elaborate, and it somehow involved Barbara Hepworth. It came from the Scilly Isles and had to come via various trucks. And you're quite right, it's on this vast washed-up tree trunk, and there are some huge pebbles around the bottom. And Jim Eade thinks very hard about where he places his art and his sculptures. So we have two sculptures in Kettle's Yard, both on pianos, one on the Steinway and one on the Bechstein, one by Garbo and one by the great modernist sculptor Brancusi. And you get used to it if you've been to Kettle's Yard, but you have to ask yourself, where else do you see sculpture of this quality sitting on pianos? And on a piano, you get these beautiful reflections, and clearly there's an idea around rhythm and reflections and the imaginary idea of the music that the sound the piano might make in relation to the sort of vibrations of the sculpture.
What would you say is special about the lighting of Kettle's Yard and the kind of, I think that's one of the things that's really struck me every time I visit. It almost seems a little bit different.
Jim Eade, who created Kettle's Yard, he said that the windows in a room were the first pictures, the light coming in, and that when you were thinking about a room, you should just clear the room completely, just stand still and notice the light coming through. So he cares enormously about the light in Kettle's Yard. I think he would love it if we didn't have any electric light at all. We do keep it to a relative minimum. And as people visit over the course of a day, different times of year, different kinds of light come in. And we take a few risks on conservation. We have to, in order for the light to interact with the furniture, the space, and with the artworks at Kettle's Yard. So you're right, it's very special. He at one point, he lived in Tangier in Morocco, and the light was very special there. Then he lived in France. For a very modern British collection with some international works, Jim was extremely international, but he loved light. He loved the sense of watching the way light flows and falls on a floor, on a sculpture, on a pathway, on flowers, cut flowers in the house.
For me, I think it's also about his attention to detail. You know, every single corner has something that it looks taken care of. Maybe, I don't know, he saw perhaps this space here and he thought, no, this can't be empty. We need to sort of show that we've thought about even that small space of wall as well.
I think that's right. And one of the reasons why many people find Kettle's Yard very moving and very personal. When I first arrived 6 years ago, the first thing I said to the friends of Kettle's Yard, a wonderful group of supporters, was the first words I said was, "It's yours, isn't it?" And that's because everybody makes it their own. They discover something that Jim Ead has placed or put down or a picture he's hung, and they feel as though they've probably spotted it for the first time. And there's something about how we're looking here at this great huge glass that's got a great crack in it that's been mended, how Jim is completely unafraid to show broken things. There are many broken things in Kettle's Yard that have been mended. And those people respond very strongly to the idea that something that's broken but perhaps mended could be very beautiful indeed. He's not afraid to suggest that beauty is not entirely, it's not flawless, it's not the reserve, just the reserve of great artists. All of us can be creative, all of us can make things or shape our environments, and that plays back, reflects the history of those objects, but also reflects our relationship to the world.
And just finally, how similar is the composition that we see here to the way Jim Ead left things?
Very. Having said his idea of provisional artworks, he was an extraordinary curator. Sir Nicholas Serota, now the chair of the Arts Council, but the very famous, very recently former director of Tate, was a student in Cambridge in the 60s. And when Sir Nicholas Serota writes about his experience of Kettle's Yard, it's as much about the quality of the works as it is even more so about the arrangements, about the energy between the objects. Jim Ead knew how to place things in such a way that it makes, you know, the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. And it ought to be annoying that everything is placed by one person. How annoying could that be? Somehow it isn't annoying. It's incredibly generous. It's very open. And somebody said famously, I mean, just a visitor said, it ought to signal, when you hear about it in advance, you think it's all going to be me, 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 all about Jim Ead. It's not. It's all about look, look, look. It's all about making you look more closely at everything that's in the house, but when you walk out of the house, look more closely and be more perceptive and sensitive to the world.
Kettle's Yard in Cambridge reopens in February 2018, and find out more at kettlesyard.co.uk. We're going to hop over the Atlantic to British Columbia now, where in Victoria you'll find the Spencer Mansion, once a stately Italianate villa constructed with the proceeds of gold rushes in Australia and America. The house has operated as an art gallery since 1951. It has an eclectic permanent collection encompassing Canadian, American and Asian art, and has hosted exhibitions from around the world. Darren Steinke paid a visit to the gallery to speak with head curator Michelle Jacques about this cultural landmark.
The Spencer Mansion, as it's known now, was built by a British architect in 1889. The architect's name is William Ridgway Wilson. The house was built for, I believe they were a wealthy family, a couple named Alexander and Theophila Green. It was a very majestic property with lands that stretched from Moss Street to Rockland.
So fast forwarding just a little bit then, talk about how the gallery came to be in the 1940s and 50s.
There was a group of residents who were trying to establish a space for showing modern art. Emily Carr was actually very involved in that group, and many other artists and art advocates who we consider to be founding individuals of this institution. They were really sort of insistent on finding a permanent home for an art gallery. And Sarah Spencer, who was the daughter of the last family to own this house, she knew of this drive, of this advocacy. She was involved in it, and she donated the house.
Can you talk a little bit about the original collections that the founder or the founding director sort of brought in, and what the original drive behind the art was to actually be housed in the mansion?
The collective were really driven by a desire to have a space to show the work of living artists. And it wasn't until they had this building and a space and hired the founding director, curator, Colin Graham, that they really started to think seriously about what the organization would collect. And Colin Graham had a real interest in bringing as diverse a collection to Victoria as possible so that the citizens of Victoria would be exposed to basically the cultures of the world. So in those early days, he was collecting European art, he was collecting Inuit art, he collected some work from Africa and South America. The Asian collection at the Art Gallery of Greater Victoria is now one of the most important collections of Asian art in Canada. Aside from that collection, we have maintained that early focus on local artists and art of the region. So I would say that really our current collecting activity reflects the early ambitions of both the collective that started the institution and our founding director. We're standing in what I presume would have been the foyer in the house originally. It's a completely wood-paneled room with a very grand fireplace. Off of the foyer, there are three rooms, the Sarah Spencer Gallery and the Massey Gallery and the Kearley Gallery. Really, it's a community space, and I think something that we've done quite well is take advantage of that kind of domestic quality of this space to kind of deinstitutionalize the art gallery a little bit.
So we're out back of the mansion and the main modern galleries. Can you tell us what we're looking at here?
In conjunction with the building of the modern galleries, this Asian garden was put in. And by that time, the Art Gallery of Greater Victoria's commitment to Asian art was well established. So this beautiful rock garden, lots of plants, Japanese maple, bamboo, a lot of things evocative of an Asian garden were put in. There's this remarkable Shinto shrine, which was brought to the Art Gallery of Greater Victoria from Japan. And I've been told that it's the only genuine Shinto shrine in North America. So it's a remarkable space.
Darren Steinke there, reporting from the Spencer Mansion in Victoria, British Columbia. House galleries are particularly useful in areas with little or no traditional art space. This is the case in South Africa's oldest township, Langa, in Cape Town, where a project to display local artists' work is utilising houses in the area. A tour of these micro-galleries has now been set up, trying to tempt people away from the city's better-known cultural hotspots. Monocle reporter Gavin Fisher went to Langa to find out more.
I'm at the first stop of my art tour of Langa Township, but there is no indication this small, cream-coloured home is a gallery. Another sign this may be a different art experience. The door is opened by the exhibiting artist himself.
This is Bob Belida.
Hello, sir.
Hello.
I'm Gavin.
Gavin.
Okay, yeah. Velile.
The walls of Velile Sohar's living room are covered with striking black and white lino-cut paintings. But these aren't the first thing he points out.
You can see the photo there on the wall. So those people were in here. 40 people from overseas, they came here.
40 people?
40 people inside the house.
What's it like having 40 people sort of trampling around your house, sort of pointing at things and touching things?
Something like that, you know. Yeah, it's okay. I mean, it's good for me. I mean, people like you to come and see the, how we live our lives in this house, in the township here.
In his 50s, Velile has exhibited throughout Cape Town, but he now only shows his work at home.
People in the township, they want to see my work here inside the house. It's like a new thing, I mean. People come from maybe overseas, you know, to come and see my work here in the township. At the same time, in galleries, I have to pay more rent.
Velile gets paid up to $7 per visitor, from a total tour cost of between $25 and $100, depending on the length. The company that organises the tours is called Mabaneng Township Arts Experience. My guide is Bongani Ngwenya.
People have an opportunity to ask the artist directly what inspires them.
As part of the tour, visitors meet and even sit down for dinner with the artists, which Bongani says improves understanding.
Tourism should be done in a very responsible way so that they also don't feel that they are being taken to an urban safari. People actually live in these areas, so these are not animals, essentially. We are now seeing the impact of people from these communities directly benefiting from the tourism footfall that does come into Langa Township. And that also leads to the very same artists being able to sell some of their artworks.
Back outside, as we walk to our next stop, it's clear the tour is about more than just the galleries.
Langa Township is the oldest township in South Africa. It was formally formed in 1924, where you found black people being forcefully removed, and Langa Township was the first area where they were put, and that's where they settled.
And then this history and the poverty that remains has inspired art in the township. But amongst the cramped rows of housing, there is little conventional display space available. It's this fact that began the tour.
We started in 2001 when Sipiwe Ngwenya, the founder of the business, could not exhibit his artwork in high-end galleries in town. He then decided to do an exhibition on the day of the event while he had his work displayed in the middle of the street. It rained. And the mothers thought to themselves that we have not had any opportunity to get people from the outside visiting our homes. Why not bring in the artworks into our homes? Hopefully she is around because she left.
Our next stop is the home of one of these mothers.
Oh, I can see the art already.
Hazel C. Aya is not an artist, but one of the community who has agreed to hang pictures in her living room.
This wall was for my family. So I decided to take out the photos of my family and I put them in the other room.
So what does your family think of you taking down their photos?
No. We first agreed.
Hazel's personality seems to be reflected in her front room, welcoming but understated, even formal. So the five large, brightly coloured paintings that hang there are rather incongruous. But she says it's worth it to meet the visitors.
I've enjoyed it because sometimes they share their way, their lifestyle, and we share with them our lifestyle.
Hazel says the money provided by the tours, though not substantial, helps support her family. At our last stop, I meet an artist for whom money is not the main aim.
My name is Nombulelo Kyangi. I'm 20 years old. I'm a visual artist and, canvas painter, basically.
You've got some art up on the walls that people are able to come and look around. Should we have a look in quickly?
Yes. Nombulelo has just started her home gallery with work she did in her final years of school.
Paintings, about 9. So obviously it's going to be like different techniques, a bit of abstract art, exactly. And then there's a bit of... it's more like natural and realistic art.
This must be a big opportunity for you as an artist.
Yes. The only audience I had was just students at school and my teachers. Now I have other people just looking at them and it feels like I'm being respected. I don't know, because it's my house and there's just a sense of respect that I'm getting from people because they're acknowledging my hard work and it's at my home and it just feels great.
The name of the tour experience, Mabaneng, means place of light, and it's clear one of the main aims is to use art to shed light on Langa. Putting aside the quality of the work on display here, which is certainly mixed, what is on offer is an invitation into the homes of residents, where life, art and history have combined. That in itself is a pretty unique experience. For Monocle, in Langa Township in Cape Town, I'm Gavin Fisher.
You can find out more about the house gallery tours in Langa at maboneng.com. That's M-A-B-O-N-E-N-G. And our final stop is to Vienna, where we're visiting a different sort of home, a temporary one. The Hotel Am Brillantengrund in Vienna's trendy 7th district doubles as just about anything. Pop-up shop, furniture market and photo gallery. Now in its 5th year, the acclaimed Photography Am Brillantengrund exhibition brings together some of Austria's best photographic talent, as well as gallery owners, promoters and, of course, the hotel's guests. Monocle's Alexei Koryalov spoke to the organisers in the run-up to the exhibition, which opens on December the 14th.
I'm Marvin Mangalino, and I run the place Hotel Am Brillantengrund. If you think Palazzo Fortuny in Venice, where he had like all the stuff that he loved, he collected it in one space, and this kind of thing inspired me, and it's just an unusual place. Like the whole thing, everything here is built up with contrasts, a whole hotel.
Marvin Mangalino took over the hotel in 2010 and quickly transformed it from a declining, rundown business into a fashionable meeting place as he branched out to retail, fashion and photography.
Yeah, we just started. And actually, the first time we did an exhibition was because of the typhoon in Tacloban in the Philippines. Then we decided how could we collect money, and we just thought, okay, let's put all the photographers together and let's sell the pictures for Christmas presents. And then we raised a pretty good sum of money. We built up 50 houses, and then it was a kind of interesting happening. And so we continued doing it because we liked the idea to do the photo exhibition every year. And especially in Vienna, you have a lot of photographers, emerging artists who are starting now.
Marvin is a photographer himself, so it seemed only natural for him to host photography exhibitions.
I have the same background somehow. I do a lot of photography for my own. That's why I like the topic. I like choosing pictures, choosing photographers, bringing people together. And
but I guess it's not only sort of a get-together for photographers and Viennese creatives. You know, you're also sort of inviting the guests at the hotel to come and visit the exhibition. Is that the idea?
Yeah, of course they like it and they enjoy it, and they're always like surprised about what kind of different things are happening in this house. Like, wow, that's your mother in the kitchen. Wow, there is like this own fashion brand, and wow, there is this exhibition. And we just keep on doing things that we like, and that's also a kind of brand mark about this place here, that we put certain things together, bring certain artists together and create projects together. So we have couple of collectors coming here that, like, okay, interesting. They realized that there is a certain content, that it's not just about name dropping. And
since its inception, Photographie am Brillantengrund has helped kickstart several careers and has become a recruiting ground for galleries and agencies, says Marvin Mangalino, the hotel owner.
You can see from the people that you can see some other famous photographers coming already, and gallerists coming, and you can see, okay, they're interested in what we're doing. And Westlicht, they were here having
the photo gallery.
Yeah, they had an event in the garage, and then they saw the pictures of Stephanie Moshammer. And then they just said, okay, that's it. And then Stephanie Moshammer had her own exhibition as well at Ostlicht. Everyone who bought a photo from Stephanie Moshammer before, or Thomas Alpdorf, they have a certain value now, even after these 2 years. Yeah. So, but at the end, it's just all about we like it and we have fun dealing with it. It's always a lot of work, but it's always a place where artists come and hide. And of course, at least that's something that we can offer to the artists who participate in the exhibition. Yeah.
Thanks, Alexei, and that's all we have time for this week. This show was produced by Holly Fisher, and we'll be back at the same time next week for this month's edition of Something Old, Something New. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.